Welcome to Ungagged. It's been a year since we did a podcast, the old one being Socialist Voices. But as you know, a lot happens in a year, and we're now ungagged. What a year it has been in politics, politics across the world and politics here in the UK, and in particular here in Scotland. Here in Scotland, for example, we have one Tory, one Labour Party-ish MP, and a Liberal Democrat who has used all of his time fighting off his constituents who are trying to have him kicked out for lying. We have a Scotland made up entirely of mad nationalists flinging their sporrans around Europe shouting, "Je suis a bloody European!" And over the past few weeks we've seen the real grassroots coming together to kickstart a promised conversation on independence. Down in England, and to a certain extent here, we have the Labour Party at last having the much needed fight over what sort of party it is. Is it a socialist party, or is it an insipid middle class, England focused knitting circle? And we have a Tory party that has at last played out its internal racist Thatcherite battle over building a wall to keep out brown people and people with accents. The racists seemed to win, and then they seemed to crash, and coke-loving George Osborne seems to have just melted in an oily slick. And of course, we have the Hillary versus Trump thing in the USA. Will mein Führer the Donald win and build his work camps, walls, and convert Scotland into one big new golf club and hunting range? Well, we'll see. On this podcast, you will hear from Labour Independence's Alan Grogan and Matt Geraghty, who will both talk about Labour's problems. You will hear Deborah Torrance on getting the Yes Gang together again, Amber Daniels on gender, Bruce Scott on the cultural hegemony of mental health, and wee Rafe from Kirky introducing himself. Any feedback on any of the contributions can be made by tweeting @_ungagged or scribbling on our Facebook page, facebook.com/leftungagged/. As usual, with some brilliant music, this is The Hurriers and You're Not Gagging Me.
There's been a lot of talk of another independence referendum. Who could blame us? What with the lack of home rule, broken promises, undelivered vows, Tory in-party fighting, Brexit, new Prime Minister with the essence of Thatcher, and Boris Bleeding Johnson as new Foreign Minister. And then, of course, Trident. If there was ever a need to demonstrate the democratic deficit with real-time evidence, you have a number in the very recent past of Westminster parliamentary debates to choose from. Let's take Trident, though, since they are, as I say these words to you, no more than 30 miles as the crow flies away from me. East Dumbartonshire would be gone in seconds under a nuclear pyroclastic cloud if there was ever an accident at Faslane. Scottish MPs elected by their constituents voted against these abominations in the recent Trident debate. 58 out of 59 Scottish MPs said no to renewing nuclear warheads and their delivery systems. Saving untold billions of taxpayers' money on weapons of mass indiscriminate murder. But alas, the UK as a whole, all the other MPs either abstained, how the heck can you abstain on such a vital matter, or voted for the renewal. Voted for spending an undisclosed amount, Scottish MPs repeatedly asked for the total, on weapons that, as the new PM casually agreed she'd prepared to, if deployed, would kill millions of innocent civilians. So, will this trigger another Scottish independence referendum? I don't see why it shouldn't. I don't want them here, yet they're here. I don't want to ever use them, yet our new PM could and would be prepared to use them in my name. So for me, independence is the only viable option. But we have to persuade those who didn't agree with us before. The margin wasn't all that big last time. For 51%, we only need a 6% swing, but I feel we could get more. In order to do this, we must work together. Recently, I've seen some commentators bumping their gums about lack of mobilisation. SNP is running a Summer of Independence initiative, and I know they are bound by electoral law, but it's on their manifesto, and I believe wholeheartedly it hasn't left any of their members' minds. But there is loads of behind-the-scenes things happening with other local groups. To quote my friend, who is up to her neck in independence activities, if they had their finger on the pulse, they would feel it coming. We are on it. Here in East Dumbartonshire, I too is cranking up the road machinery. All the cogs are getting oiled and contacts going out. Meetings being arranged, events planned. Loads is happening. I'm getting emails every day, folk talking about what they're doing, old social media accounts waking up. We're getting ready to go. So, open up your old emails, get in touch with all your old groups, get your canvassing shoes looked out, badges polished. As everyone keeps saying, the band is getting back together. And I want to do like an air guitar there. Cheers.
As the pen of decision, my decay. The words from a place of comfort lost. Will I be there to feel the cost? I left love on a windy hill. My heart entrusted to a darling girl. The words entwined, I can feel them still. Alone with love on a windswept hill.
Experience takes its fill. And when it's
cannot feel, he is alive. Oh, so worthwhile a war survived. La 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 la.
Songwriter Stuart McFarlane and his song The Medal. Next is a piece by Dr. Bruce Scott. This is part one of his piece on the cultural hegemony of mental health.
My name is Dr. Bruce Scott. I am a psychologist and psychoanalyst who lives in Scotland. Mental health is a phrase everybody uses at the drop of a hat without thinking. The phrase seems harmless, common sense, and obvious to use for so many people, especially and surprisingly for people involved in left politics. How can too little words be of any consequence? How can the use of too little words derail a leftist critique of capitalism or even back up the system the left intends to critique? I want to be clear, however, although I am critical of the term mental health, I am in no way diminishing the mental distress that people feel. However, it is important to recognise how the use and consequences of the term mental health does detract from the real suffering of people. To paraphrase Michel Foucault, the French philosopher, I would like to show that the root of mental pathology or mental health must not be sought in some kind of metapathology, but in a certain relationship historically situated of people in relation to others and to the truthfulness or limits of truth regarding mental distress. When one uses the term mental health in a context where it means everything, for example, talking about mental distress, the concept of health and ill health or illness subsumes the all of the context. However, the concept has so much slippage when subjected to a detailed critical analysis, it deteriorates into a phantasm that continually haunts in the background, because the concept cannot contain or represent in an ideal way when it comes to human experience. The term dictates experience, how to experience, how to predict experience, and how to disavow experience from other viewpoints. The frightening thing is, it seems nobody believes in ghosts, especially when it comes to the concept, the haunting ghost of mental health. The great French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan had a lot of critical things to say about mental health and about activists demanding things. In 1969, Just after the famous events in Paris in May 1968, Jacques Lacan said to his revolutionary students, open quote, "If you had a bit of patience, and if you really wanted our impromptus to continue, I would tell you that, always, the revolutionary aspiration has only one single possible outcome, of ending up as the master's discourse. This is what experience has proved. What you aspire to as revolutionaries is a master. You will get one." End quote. Activists from all walks and all political persuasions who take up this gauntlet have all the hallmarks of Lacan's revolutionaries when it comes to mental health. For example, on one particular left-leaning social media discussion forum in Scotland at the beginning of 2015, some people were discussing the possibility of a position on mental health. The ideas put forward were for the most part concerned with campaigning for more or better mental health services and getting more cognitive behavioural therapy, especially the more economically viable computerised version of cognitive behavioural therapy. The content of this online discussion, from some supposed radical left socialist activists, to my mind reeked of neoliberalism. The vision that some of these activists had of the person with poor mental health was of someone who possessed a faulty cognitive machine that had to be fixed, or had a faulty neurotransmitter system in the brain that had to be corrected with drugs. More recently, some have argued that a core demand from the left to the state has to be good mental health. There is, from all these activists and many others like them, no interrogation of the concept of mental health from a critical, psychoanalytical or philosophical perspective, as one might expect from the left, for example, from a Foucauldian, Lacanian or Derridean perspective. The uncritical acceptance of such a term may seem harmless, but that is the ruse which capitalism wants to play to trick you. To paraphrase Kevin Spacey's character from the film The Usual Suspects, the greatest trick the devil played was to convince people he did not exist. The same could be said that the uncritical acceptance of the concept of mental health is a trick as well. The confusion and subsequent alienation that the ideology or discourse of mental health brings to our psychological reality is compounded and perpetrated by the discipline of psychology, which purports to be a neutral science of the mind and behaviour. As the philosopher Boyne in 2010 argues, rather than contesting alienation and confusion, which is the cultural hegemony of mental health, psychology exacerbates alienation and moves to celebrate them in a positivist carnival of inauthenticity. Alienation from ourselves is positively encouraged through psychobiological frameworks, including genetic theories, which permeate the discipline of psychology and dispute and destabilise ideas of free will and responsibility. The crux of this matter is, under psychology, human beings are purported to be machines, and machines become faulty and need fixing. We are not faulty cognitions, and we are not faulty neurotransmitters. Further, R.D. Lang and Aaron Esterstin's research on families and Jules Henry's anthropological research has highlighted long ago, and subsequently been suppressed from academic teachings, that it is people and situations that drive us mad and make us miserable. Let me explain further and elaborate. The mental health system, which includes psychology, psychiatry and academia, plays a pivotal role in shoring up and defining our psychological lives, which underpins acceptance of capitalism. If so-called activists took the time to inquire into the concept of mental health and its foundations, i.e. the philosophical, biological, political and economic, then a different kind of activism might emerge, rather than the knee-jerk reaction to campaign to the masters to demand more mental health. Alan Francis, the former lead editor of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders in 2013, The book which gives our present culture all the labels we use when it comes to mental health declared that there was no satisfactory definition of a mental disorder and that those which have been offered are bullshit and you just can't define it. The validity and reliability of such disorders are so poor that if the method of DSM criteria was to be used with physical disorders, it would be rejected wholeheartedly by the medical community. The basic categories of mental disorder, which are outlined in the DSM, have not been arrived at through painstaking research, but through the operation of committees. Practitioners cannot decide with any consistency who or who does not have a constructed disorder. A good example is schizophrenia, where research shows that barely half of highly trained psychiatrists and practitioners schooled in the medicalisation of mental disorders believe in the label. It is a hypothetical disorder for which no medical tests exist and mental health practitioners cannot agree on its diagnosis. Worse still, the operation of these committees has been thoroughly corrupted by the influence of the pharmaceutical industry. Strong financial ties have been identified to operate between pharmaceutical companies and those who are responsible for developing the diagnostic criteria for mental disorders. One needs to be aware that the function of psychology and psychiatry within a capitalist system is to expand the category of the mentally ill or mental ill health, thereby creating consumers of psychopharmacological products and to rely upon state-sanctioned psychotherapies of adaption, therapies which are sanctioned by the capitalist state on the basis of propping up the cultural hegemony of mental health. This system creates fear and submission to an ideology which controls and mystifies the masses. Marx recognised this assault of alienation and mystification upon the subject. Marx theorised that the proletariat under capitalism is no longer a subject. Under capitalism, the subject is not permitted. We cannot free associate. The subject has to produce good mental health, positive cognitions, etc. A perfect foreclosure of free subjecthood and of uncertainty. An uncertainty which needs to be. As language and reason cannot contain all of the truth of what it is to be human and to live. Capitalism transforms the labouring power of the subject into an object, objectifying and reflecting the scientific knowledge of our epoch, to abide by pseudo-scientific truths of what is mental health and what is not. Let me be clear. It needs to be understood that there is no good evidence to suggest that there are any biological deficits, genetic abnormalities or chemical imbalances related to mental ill health or mental disorders. The evidence base for the myth of mental illness is so poor. There are no medical tests a physician can give you to test for a mental illness. And just to add, like the poor science of the taxonomy of mental disorders, psychometric tests of mental health problems do not validate the truth of having a so-called mental disorder. But back to biology. The work of Mary Boyle on schizophrenia, David Healy, Irvin Kirsch on depression and SSRI antidepressants, Joanna Moncrief on so-called biochemical imbalances and so-called mental illness, and Cutchins and Kirk on the mythology, nosology and taxonomy of mental disorders shows well enough that the cultural hegemony of mental health from a medico-biological perspective is a dangerous myth and perpetrated by corrupt drug companies and people with vested interests. This is the end of part one. In part two, I will discuss a critique of psychological therapies, state philosophy and what a psychoanalytic perspective on mental distress means for mental health. Thank you. Devastation, it hits me like a bullet. Murder, your demons make me broken and betrayed. Your bitterness feels sick in my stomach. I only love you 'cause you'll never go away.
piece is so torn and grey that that dead man's bullet shut you down, shut you down. Dead man's bullet shut you down, shut you down.
Louise Distress and Bullets. Alan Grogan was one of the people who brought together what became an important strand of the Yes movement a few years ago. A committed Labour Party supporter and member, he helped to form Labour for Independence. Yorkshireman Matt Geraghty, who you will hear after Alan, is a Brighton-based writer and activist.
The Labour Party is in crisis, but has also never been more successful. 172 Labour MPs have given their leader a vote of no confidence. All the while, this same leader has managed to attract over 600,000 members, making it the largest socialist party in Europe. His opposition to this Conservative government has never looked so impotent, thanks to the coordinated resignations of the PLP. Yet it has never been so needed. With Brexit, the pound in free fall, another recession looming, and a new Prime Minister looking intent on more austerity and with stricter restrictions on social liberty, never has there been a more important time to be an effective opposition. Why then has the Labour Party went into meltdown? The plotters would tell you it's because Jeremy Corbyn is unelectable, that you would have lost the next general election. But the reality is that thanks to their own actions, they've all but guaranteed a Tory victory in 2020. So let's be very clear from the offset who will be responsible if we face another 9 years of Conservative government. Corbyn and his brand of politics might not be to the press's liking, or even most of his MPs, but it has shown itself to be effective. Over 500,000 members belong to the Labour Party. In 4 by-elections, Labour have won them all, increasing the share of the vote in all but one. They've won mayoral elections as well. His record as opposition leader is far more effective than Ed Miliband's ever was, helping to stop more anti-trade union laws, aided by the House of Lords, prevented over 3 million families losing over £1,000 a year in tax credit cuts. He also defeated the government's plans to cut thousands in disability benefit. His opposition also helped abolish the tampon tax. So effective in opposition that by April this year, the New Statesman hailed him as one of history's great opposition leaders already. Opinion polls showed that Labour began to overtake the Tories, with an Ipsos Mori poll showing an 8-point swing to Labour to give them a 5-point lead the week before the EU referendum. Since the coup, any such lead has been shattered. The Tories now have an 11-point lead. Attacked by the media and his own MPs, any purposeful opposition Corbyn has had at PMQs has been washed away, which has left him easy pickings for rude and undignified rebuttals by both Cameron and now May. At this point in time, it would be fair to point out that I'm not a Corbynista or a member of Momentum. I see that Jeremy is not the perfect leader, but he is the right leader at the right time for this Labour Party. I believe that with the disaster that was Brexit, with a marked change in the public opinion on austerity and inequality, that we are beginning to see that it would have been possible, despite opposition from Labour grandees, some of whom had 8 years and still never won an election, and the mainstream media, that the message Jeremy Corbyn spread could have been successful at the next general election. But now, thanks to the plotters, the schemers, and those who, for the last 22 years, have attempted to rip the heart and fabric of the Labour Party, the Tories may, in all likelihood, have been handed another general election victory. So the big question has to be why. Why, after only 9 months of successful opposition, have the plotters decided to cut Corbyn off at the knees? Why go against the membership and the democratic mandate Corbyn received from them only 9 months ago? The simple reason is that they fear Corbyn. Or perhaps not the man, but what and who he represents. The very establishment that has controlled Westminster and UK politics has been shaken to the core in the past 4 years. From the establishment of the Yes Movement in Scotland to the ascension of Jeremy Corbyn, it is clear that the mood is one of change. For too long, politicians and businesses have scammed the system, claiming huge expenses, deregulating the banks, deals for their friends who are CEOs of major corporations, all playing fast and loose, which has led to the economic downturn. And when the rails did come off, rather than repent and accept the blame, the buck has been passed on to the poorest in our society. Increased tuition fees, cuts in education budgets and social security spending, public sector wage freezes, food banks becoming a necessary evil, and now more and more children living in poverty. All the while, the rich sending money to offshore accounts, and multinational corporations pay a fraction of the tax that they are supposed to. The millennials, the poor, the working class and the squeezed middle have decided that enough is enough and a change is needed. Much like Bernie Sanders offered in America, Corbyn offers that change. He is not beholden to big business, nor does he have the vested interest of the mainstream media, which explains their reticence towards him. Corbyn offers an alternative. His anti-war, anti-trident, anti-austerity message offers a new kind of politics, on which the establishment, the media, the politicians on both sides of the aisle cannot understand. All they see is their gravy train slipping away. There have been many false dawns on the road to change. Obama offered so much, but ultimately conformed to the norm. The Yes Movement in Scotland changed our politics here forever. But thanks to Project Fear, a majority of the 50-plus years voters supporting the union survived, at least for now. Over the next 10 years, I believe we will see a permanent revolution in our politics. I believe Scotland will become independent. I believe that the rest of the UK will either fall into perpetual Torydom or radically alter their nature of politics. That's how important this Labour leadership election is. For pro-independence voters like myself, we must still support Jeremy Corbyn and his allies in this fight. As I said earlier, Corbyn is the right leader at the right time for Labour. There's also more than that. Any independence movement in Scotland must bring with it the Labour movement. That's why it was pleasing to see Alex Rowley's comments supporting a second referendum. An independent Scotland must acknowledge and accept that its closest partner geographically and politically should and will be the rest of the UK. We must seek to have a partner in this who will promote the values of fairness, equality and social justice. Only a real Labour Party that is led by Alex Corbyn can possibly remove the establishment agenda that has promoted inequality and poverty for so long. Furthermore, as socialists, it's our duty to support and ensure a better life for our comrades in other nations. I said this many times during the first referendum, that my solidarity doesn't end at Dover, and it won't end at Berwick and independent Scotland. To paraphrase the great political leaders, Simon Bolivar, political gangrene cannot be cured with politics. And Britain is totally and utterly infected with gangrene. A green mango will ripen, but a rotten mango never ripens. The seeds of a rotten mango must be saved and planted so that a new plant may grow. While only independence and the advancement of an independent Scottish Labour Party will allow that to happen to Scotland, in the rest of the UK, the real change will come from the message that Corbyn spreads. The leadership elections are not a case of Corbyn versus Smith, or momentum versus progress, or either real Labour versus new. This is a defining moment in the politics of the UK and where its future may lie. It is the establishment against a fairer, more equal alternative. It is the status quo against real and quantitative change. For our sakes, Corbyn must win and create a Labour Party fit to oppose the viciousness of May's government and provide a real and credible alternative to create the lasting change so many of us now seek.
For many in the Parliamentary Labour Party, and much of the right, the past is eternally present, and political history hasn't moved a solitary inch. It is the imbecile road followed by those who hope, through force of belief alone, to hold back time. Believers who live as though change had never happened and politics can continue as usual. But this is not so. However much they project an image of the world as they want it to be, they find themselves butting up against the world as it is, myth versus reality. It's a paradigm shift that first took legs in the wake of 2015's general election, a period when all parties failed equally, and we found ourselves ruled by a government that over 60% of the population had neither voted for nor wanted. But although the change was in the air, it took the accidental election of Jeremy Corbyn to give shape and face to the transformed landscape. The unexpected consequences of a seemingly innocuous act by those MPs who got Corbyn placed upon the ballot paper. For his nomination was viewed as little more than an opportunity to end once and for all the debate that socialism had a place in the party. But Zeitgeist and the constituency membership dealt their hopes an annihilating verdict. A verdict that fell upon the scene with a shattering crash, liberating the present and burying the past. Or so we might have thought. Yet instead of shaking them from their dreams, this judgment has instead entrenched many MPs in the fossil of the past, and like those who fought to preserve the truth of the flat earth, no matter what the weight of evidence to the contrary, they appear willing to continue on their idiotic caper until the bitter end. But what is most fascinating is that this rejection of the current paradigm has crossed the party and journalistic divide, with the PLP, Tories and the media joining the fray. The attacks are aimed at Corbyn, but this is something of a red herring. What is really being attacked is his approach to politics and life, an approach that has found the ear of the common man and woman. After 20 years of lies and false pretense, authenticity is the order of the day. Corbyn is no messiah, he's just a man. But a man who has been consistent in his beliefs over time, in the face of the fickle winds of politics. Perhaps what Corbyn does more than anything else is act as a yardstick against which the withered morals and self-interest of politics of recent history can be measured. He holds a mirror up to his opponents, and they are faced with an uncomfortable truth. But truth is not a currency many in the PLP want to deal in. And this rejection of the new reality has seen a self-serving idiocracy of MPs looking for any way to push the genie back in the box. They have bleated about Corbyn having not shown himself to be of leadership material, yet when has he had a chance to be the leader? Attacked from all sides the moment he took office, the situation has unfolded like Shakespeare's Julius Caesar played as a farce, with the stabbing occurring in the opening scene and continuing until the closing speech. They have simply looked for every opportunity to try and pin some perceived failing on him, Brexit being the latest and most significant, although anyone with eyes to see and brain to think would understand their whining was based upon what they would like to be, not what was actually the case. The Tory voters and those on the right brought about the separation, not Corbyn. But never once to let the truth get in the way of a good story, these duplicitous individuals have complained that his unwillingness to step down the back of their intimidation risked tearing the party apart. This is merely their attempt to give truth to lies, for it will be the relentless scheming of many of his MPs that will cause the rupture, if it comes to that. Unfortunately for them, their bluff has been called, and their undemocratic and bullying ways exposed, for they are the ones without support. And should the action of disenfranchising tens of thousands of new members result in Owen Smith being foisted on the constituency party, the victory will be pyrrhic, for the PLP will be ahead without a body, and enter into a pointless future. So like Canute, these MPs have backed themselves into a corner, committed themselves to the impossible, for the political tide will not be halted, and if they did at some future point find the party implodes, they need look no further than their own fraudulent actions for any answer to the question why.
Exposed. Or will it come and find me? I could be waiting for you for a long, long time.
I Have to Look for Love. Amber Daniels is an activist from Birmingham. She writes a blog, the Amber Daniels Journal, .blogspot.co.uk, on her experiences as a transgender woman. This is her piece, Times of Change.
Teachers, parents and peers teach us much about the surrounding world during our younger years. Yet they're not the only major source of influence, as the media plays a pretty sizable role in dishing out information to our easily impressed infant minds. The media is a forever changing beast, one which often reshapes itself as time goes on. I grew up during the 1990s, a period which many would argue was a progressive time within modern history. In some ways, this is true, but as is always the case, there was still much room for improvement. Growing up as a transgendered child back then wasn't exactly fun. Well, it was not for me, anyway. I knew I was different from around the age of 6. I didn't want to live as a boy, despite everyone telling me that I was one. Growing up with feelings and thoughts contradicting the gender I was assigned at birth was exceptionally isolating, if anything. No one in my immediate life ever expressed similar thoughts to the ones I was harbouring, at least not publicly anyway. For a long while, I was convinced that I was the only person in the world who felt this way. But then one day, a TV programme popped up, and for the first time ever, I realised that I wasn't alone. A daytime chat show exposed me to the tale of an unsuspecting young man whose girlfriend had a secret she so desperately wished to share with him. It turns out that this gentleman's lady friend used to live as a man. Gasps from the studio audience as this beautiful blonde revealed her biological past. Her boyfriend eventually came on stage, only to be told the news of his lover's secret history in front of a room filled with amused onlookers. Anger, confusion, and disgust sent the man into a frenzy. He threatened his girlfriend, expressed utter revulsion at what she'd just shared with him, and was finally escorted away by security whilst an audience whooped and cheered. The media had just informed my young, impressionable mind that there were indeed other people like me out there. Yet in the eyes of the wider world, we were shocking, nauseating life forms who weren't deserving of another's love. Soon after that, I saw a film called Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. As the plot to this mediocre movie dragged on, it soon became apparent that the film's villain was once, also, a man. The joke behind this was, well, it was that she was once a man. And that's it. Apparently, that fact is utterly hilarious. Someone born as one gender but presents as another is an utter hoot, according to this film. As I got older and the 90s turned into the noughties, I came across a documentary about a woman living alone, estranged from her family and laughed at by many who passed her during her day-to-day life. This woman, yet again, was assigned a man at birth, but now was living as a woman. The documentary framed her in a light which suggested she was an anomaly, a character living on the fringes of society, disliked and alienated from the world that she existed within. The noughties sauntered forth, and in 2004, Sky One decided to air a show called The Something About Miriam. The premise of the show was relatively straightforward. A group of men battled it out to win over the heart of a beautiful young woman. The twist of the show was that Miriam used to live as, yes, you guessed it, a man. When the secret was finally revealed, the competing men grew angry and disgusted. Several of them allegedly went on to sue the producers for entrapment. The message behind this show? Transgender women are deceivers who fool unsuspecting heterosexual men into finding them attractive. And these were the impressions that I got about transgendered folk from the mainstream media whilst I was growing up. Radio, television and newspapers portrayed gender-variant folk as deceitful, lonely, hated, hilarious creatures whose sole purposes were to entrap heterosexual men, shock the public by revealing personal details about their biological history, and be laughed at by anyone who happened to cross paths with their existence. No matter where one looked, there seldom seemed to be any representations which opposed these sorts of views. The laughs, the shocks, the revulsion thrived. Yet no talk shows or sitcoms or comedy films or game shows seem to even hint at the possibility that maybe, just maybe, trans people were actually complex human beings who came in different shapes and sizes and contributed more to society than simply just being shocking sensation stories who could entrap and humour the masses. Yet little did I know that as I was growing up, this tiny little thing called the internet had been growing in the background. And gradually, as if from out of nowhere, things began to change. Forums and communities sprung from the abyss of this digital wasteland, creating safe spaces for gender-variant people to share and discuss their experiences and struggles with one another. Advice was swapped, knowledge was passed down to younger, non-conforming folk such as myself, and tales of the different types of prejudice experienced were shared. A safe haven to express and discuss gender identity became accessible from the screens of many around the world. Amongst the advice and sharing of stories came the accessibility of external resources too. Recommendations to books written by Kate Bornstein and Leslie Feinberg helped me to discover that not only was it completely normal for me to not identify as the gender I was assigned on the day of my birth, but that people like myself have existed since the dawn of time. The forums and websites of the early to mid-noughties grew stronger with the advent of social media. Eventually, the likes of sites such as Tumblr, Twitter, and Facebook allowed trans people to share their life stories, experiences, and opinions at a far faster rate and at a more accessible one than ever before. Not only did it become quicker and easier for anyone and everyone to share information, but the use of images and videos meant we could also produce such information in a far more visually friendly manner. Our existences grew more visible, reaching not only other gender-variant folk, but to those beyond that community as well. Slowly but surely, a portrayal of trans people was bleeding out into the mainstream, one which showed just how multifaceted and diverse we really were. We weren't simply sensation stories who deceived and shocked, but we were people's children, friends, colleagues, allies, and lovers. We varied in appearance, had fascinating pasts, and a whole history of personal struggles which many had never before ever heard about. The internet helps not only to strengthen a community once fragmented and alienated from one another, but also constructed a counter-narrative to those carved out by films, television, radio, newspapers, and magazines. Now there was a medium challenging such a narrative, offering a far more complex and fascinating reality to the world of gender nonconformity. And with time, that alternative narrative began to spread into the older mediums which once mocked, belittled, and stigmatized trans people. Radios began holding serious discussions on the struggles and experiences which trans people face. Renowned filmmakers such as Louis Theroux produced documentaries exploring the lives of transgendered children and their families. Mainstream news outlets such as The Guardian began defending trans folk whenever public figures like Jermaine Greer decided to sprout transphobic rhetoric. Channel 4 released a whole season's worth of trans-related documentaries which explored the differing angles of being gender-variant. BBC Three decided to start bringing awareness to Trans Remembrance Day every November 20th. And leading UK soap operas such as EastEnders made the decision to hire a transgendered actor to play a transgender role. The media's perception of trans people is changing drastically, and as a result, so is society's. We now live in a world where public figures such as Caitlyn Jenner and the Wachowski sisters are openly transitioning. Transgender performers such as Laverne Cox are receiving Emmy nominations for their roles in leading television dramas. News outlets such as Vice and The Guardian are giving trans journalists like Paris Lee's platforms to share their stories and ideas upon. Schools have begun announcing new guidelines to help teachers handle the increasing number of transgendered students in their classrooms. And gender clinics across the land are seeing 28-fold increases in referrals over just an 8-year period. Furthermore, people whose genders do match the ones they were assigned at birth are coming forward and defending the rights of trans and other genderqueer people. There are, of course, many who still assault, ridicule, and despise trans people for merely existing. Yet no longer do we live in a world where such bigotry is completely brushed under the table by 99% of our population. The level of transphobia found in every society is still far too high. Yet slowly we are beginning to see more and more people coming to our aid and defending us from the hatred and intolerance that we often experience. As Louis Theroux so rightly put it in an interview, society is currently going through the hangover phase of transphobia. While as recent as 10 years ago, most were still openly mocking and spouting stupid opinions regarding gender non-conforming individuals. We now live in a world that's gradually beginning to wake up and realise the moronic nature of yesterday's actions. The detox has begun. The poisons of transphobia are still very much alive, yet slowly we can see it being cleansed from the structures of our cultures and societies. The world is changing, and it's hard not to see the vast growth of the internet as a key player in this totemic shift in attitude. The progressive counter-narrative which stemmed from the use of forums and social media has bled into the more traditional forms of media. Simultaneously, it has also passed on to those who consume it. Not all forms of the media have changed their stance, of course, just as not all forms of prejudice have left the minds of those living within our society. Yet as each year passes, the hostility gradually begins to weaken. We are on a tipping point right now. Transphobia is still very much a part of our world. But hopefully, if we continue down this path of understanding and progression, we may well someday find ourselves in a world where trans people are seen by most as the human beings that we so rightly are. The stereotypes of yesterday were harmful and hateful, and it seems as though the rest of the world are beginning to see that, as these antiquated views wither and fade into history.
Track there by Blossoms, Cut Me and I'll Bleed. Finally, the moment many on Twitter have been waiting for. Rafe, that wee scamp from Kirky, at last introduces himself on the podcast. Rafe will be doing future spots here on Ungagged. So please keep listening over the next few weeks. After Rafe, you will hear Abel Gance with Thank You. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with more polemics, analysis and banter in around a month. In the meantime, this was Neil Scott at NW Socialist on Twitter. Remember, you can play this podcast as often as you want and look up the brilliant bands and singers featured. And remember, keep fighting the Tories.
Hello, it's me, Rafe Abba Twitter. I'm not joking, it's really me. If you're not following my tweets, you're going to hang some after my heat. If you do follow him, you're going to know I'm after my heat. I was asked to do a wee podcast thing, and at first I think, no danger, I'm too shy. Then I think, hi Norris, get your words of wisdom out to the masses. So I say, aye, no bother. And it was suggested for the first one, I just tell you about myself, my family, and my best pals in the whole world, Kurt and wee Vinny. So here you go. I live with my dad and my wee dog, Steve Buscemi, in a wee village no 40-50. A lot of folk wonder about my dog's name, but he just kinda looked like Steve Buscemi. No offence to the great man himself, but there's no two pun of my wee dog hanging the right way. He has big googly eyes and his tooth ball was hanging out to dry. His hat in the right place. Then it sees his mad wee face off falls in love with him. I wonder if that's the same for the real Steve Buscemi. Probably no, eh? As you can imagine, there's no much to do in our village. So me and my pals spend most of our time having mad adventures and planning a revolution. Hey, Vinny, you know the little bright is button in a picnic? He's always telling me a revolution no going to be televised. In his house, that's true. Because I tell you he's repossessed a couple of months ago because his mammy couldn't keep up with the repayments. I tend to be saved for Kurt's house. How can I put it politely? Kurt's one of them folk that thinks it's okay to wear matching jumpers with his dad. They've never had a telly because they're too busy growing vegetables at the back garden. His mammy makes most of his clothes herself, but I suppose leaving a telly out of horn-spun wool's a wee bit out of reach. Me and my dad has a massive telly that he found one day on his way to work. I don't know what his job is, but he mostly do a night shift, and his uniform's a ski mask. Which is actually quite funny, because he can't ski. And what about me, you ask? Well, I suppose if you hang about and you let me do another podcast, you'll find out. I'll just tell you this. I tend to, I write books, I draw cartoons, and I can't spell to save myself. To be honest, there's a lot of other things I can't spell and all. And did I tell you I was a pilot? No? Well, maybe another day. In the meantime, do the wee follow at Rafe Says on Twitter. I mean, I can go down.
Arian a boch, mar cio mwy hwylen. Un ar gorm, ages glas, os yw i'r gallu o'na.
and now I say, from her and me, for who we be, thank you. And now I say, from her and me, for who we be, thank you. Children new, blessing you, memories are made.